Thank you very much, Chris. Thanks to all of you for being here. Thank you, Jesse, for engaging in this discussion. It's rare for me to be the person on a panel who's presenting the glass half full. Actually, I'd say three-quarters full in terms of the successes of originalism. But I want to emphasize here that I think you need to have sensible expectations about what originalism can accomplish based on a good understanding of what it is. And I hope to untangle originalism from other important aspects of the conservative legal project. So I'm going to start by talking about what originalism is and what it isn't. I'm then going to explain how, taking the long view, originalism has been amazingly successful over the last several decades, including on issues of religion. And finally, if time allows, or in the Q&A, I'm going to talk about some of the vulnerabilities or inadequacies of originalism. So let's start off with what originalism is and what it isn't. I want to emphasize that there is a necessary division of labor, a division of responsibilities within the conservative movement generally, and within the conservative legal movement in particular. Originalism plays an important but limited role in the conservative legal movement. Originalism is a method or theory about how to interpret legal texts, how best to determine the meaning of any legal text. It says, in essence, look to the meaning of the provision at the time that it was enacted. And I think the common sense appeal of originalism can be easily illustrated through a couple examples. Take the provision in the Constitution that says that in order to be eligible to be president, you must be a natural-born citizen. Well, what does that term mean? Well, there actually have been some disputes about it over the last 15 years, and everyone has understood that in trying to figure out what that means, you don't ask yourself now, gosh, what does natural-born citizen seem to mean? Well, natural-born reminds me of natural childbirth, so maybe only if your mother gave birth to you by natural childbirth are you eligible to be president. No, everyone understands that you look back and try to understand what that term meant at the time that it was adopted, at the time that it was incorporated into the Constitution. Another example from the Constitution, a provision in the Constitution says that the United States shall protect each state, quote, against domestic violence. Well, these days, the phrase domestic violence involves spousal abuse. No one thinks that this provision, or I should say, any minimal historical inquiry would quickly establish that this provision has nothing to do with that, and is instead ensuring that the United States would protect states against insurrections in their states. So again, the same simple common sense appeal is, let's look to what this phrase meant when it was made part of the Constitution, and that's the elementary insight that applies. The originalism applies to any legal text. It applies it to the original Constitution, to the Bill of Rights, to the later amendments, to statutes, and originalism would apply that as well to constitutions and laws from other countries. The originalism applies to good constitutions and bad constitutions. It enables you to figure out whether a constitution is good or bad, good statutes and bad statutes. Now, if a constitutional text embeds natural law principles, then the text will be interpreted in accordance with those principles. If it doesn't embed those principles, it won't. Originalism arose in opposition to a sort of freestyle living constitutionalism that uses many different names. Basically, where for many decades, especially under the Warren Court, but continuing into the Burger Court and in many cases the Rehnquist Court and the Roberts Court, justices were just making it up. They saw phrases in the Constitution as delegations of power to them to say whatever they thought was just. And that could mean, you know, abortion on demand through all 9 months of pregnancy. It could mean inventing a right to same-sex marriage, whole host of other things. Completely undisciplined, unconstrained approach to the Constitution. Originalism aims to counter that. Now, what originalism is not a constitutional or political philosophy. It's not a theory about what ought to be in a good constitution. It's not a declaration that our own constitution is a work of genius. All of those matters are beyond the realm of an interpretive method, what can be expected of an interpretive method. Originalism, for example, doesn't speak at all to the question whether the presidency should be limited to natural-born citizens. It simply interprets what that restriction means. So within the conservative legal movement, it's not the role of originalism to enact legal text. That's the role for legislators, and I think it's fair to say the conservative legal movement has been focused too much on judges, and we need to devote resources to legislatures and working with legislators to enact laws that will withstand challenge. It's also, of course, the role of the people through constitutional amendments to enact legal texts that implement their vision of the good. It's not the role of originalism to promote religious belief, or to instill virtue, or to pursue one or another vision of the common good. Those are projects that are simply beyond the scope of what an interpretive method can or should do. But originalism, as applied to our Constitution, creates or restores room for those projects to operate. Second, taking the long view, originalism has been amazingly successful. I was a law clerk for Justice Scalia during the year in which Planned Parenthood versus Casey was decided, 1992. No one back then thought that we would ever be where we are today. It's unimaginable from that perspective that we would ever have seen Roe overturned. It's unimaginable from that time that we would see the court built that we have. Now, there's plenty of room to gripe and complain that about different rulings, and I'm not claiming the court is perfect. But we, people whose memory doesn't extend beyond the day before yesterday, I think fail to appreciate the incredible successes that we have had. The year after I clerked for Justice Scalia, I worked for Senator Hatch on Judiciary Committee. I was his lead staffer on the Ginsburg and Breyer nominations. The operating procedure for Republican senators then was to roll over and play dead. They did not want to fight on grounds of judicial philosophy. They thought they would lose. They had lost big on the Bork debacle in 1987. The big loss in Planned Parenthood versus Casey told them, look, this is a loser for us. Let's just let these folks go through. And, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was confirmed 96-3. And Justice Breyer by nearly as large a margin. What happened between the early 90s and now is the remarkable success of originalism, owing in large part to Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas spelling out what originalism is, making an appealing case for it, also the Federalist Society, providing in law schools throughout the country an alternative education to the miseducation they're getting through their constitutional law courses. And you've seen this flourishing of the conservative legal movement that played out during the Trump administration with his three appointees to the Supreme Court. And you even see in the whole transformation of the Supreme Court confirmation process where in the early 90s, it would have been unimaginable that a Republican president would someday nominate someone whose record in life indicated that she was pro-life, and that they would be willing to fight on Roe. But we won the public debate over originalism, and that enabled us to get justices like Amy Coney Barrett confirmed to the Supreme Court, and obviously appointees like that were essential to the Dobbs ruling just last year. And what you see also in the Supreme Court confirmation process is you see the Democratic appointees pretending to be originalists, talking the talk of conservative legal rhetoric in a way that they never would have before. Sotomayor and Kagan in 2009 and 2010 emphatically repudiated the very empathy standard that Barack Obama said he used to select them. Ketanji Brown Jackson just last year claimed that she was an originalist. Now, there's a downside to this. Obviously, folks are trying to co-opt a method that's been successful, and there are risks to that. But overall, this reflects the political triumph and now the legal triumph of originalism. On issues of religion, there have been important successes as well. I want to highlight what's happened in the area of the Establishment Clause. Back in 1971, in a case called Lemon v. Kurtzman, Chief Justice Warren Burger, a Nixon appointee, pulled out of his ear a three-part test on whether something satisfies the Establishment Clause. Completely malleable, you can play any of these elements however you want, but a law satisfies the Establishment Clause, he said, only if it has a secular purpose, has a principal or primary effect that neither advances nor inhibits religion, and does not cause an excessive entanglement of government with religion. Each of those elements has terms that are utterly indeterminate. An excessive entanglement. Well, who can tell what is an entanglement and what's excessive? I'm going to, I love to quote Justice Scalia. This is from an opinion that he wrote in 1993 against the Lemon Test. A case called Lamb's Chapel v. Center Mauritius Union Free School District. Like some ghoul in a late night horror movie that repeatedly sits up in its grave and shuffles abroad after being repeatedly killed and buried, Lemon stalks our Establishment Clause jurisprudence once again, frightening the little children and school attorneys of Center Mauritius Union Free School District. Over the years, no fewer than five of the currently sitting justices have, in their own opinions, personally driven pencils through the creature's heart, and a sixth has joined in opinion doing so. The secret of the Lemon's Test survival, he said, is that it is so easy to kill. It's there to scare us and our audience when we wish it to do so, but we can command it to return to the tomb at will. When we wish to strike down a practice that forbids, we invoke it. When we wish to uphold a practice that forbids, we ignore it entirely. Such a docile and useful monster is worth keeping around, at least in a somnolent state. One never knows when one might need him. Well, last year, in addition to Dobbs overturning Roe, the court, in a case called Kennedy v. Bremerton School District, stated that Lemon had been overruled. Lemon is gone now. The Establishment Clause is interpreted in accordance with historical understandings of what's allowed and what's not, and it's a huge advance in this area. Second major area of constitutional decision-making on religion, of course, involves the Free Exercise Clause. Here, the matter is less clear, in large part because there's a real divide among originalists as to what the Free Exercise Clause means. And we'll see whether the court resolves this soon. Many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the case of Employment Division v. Smith that Justice Scalia authored back in 1990. This is a case that gives very little protection to free exercise claims. Basically says that if a law is neutral and generally applicable, then there's no free exercise claim against that law. To put this concretely, if during the prohibition period there had been the prohibition had extended, say, to use of wine for sacramental purposes, there would not have been a violation of the Free Exercise Clause. The court has whittled away at this. Justice Alito has called for its overturning, but this really is an area where originalists disagree on what the Free Exercise Clause means. I would emphasize, though, that even under Scalia's narrower view of the Free Exercise Clause, there's plenty of room for the political processes in the states and in the federal government to operate to protect religious belief. On the vulnerabilities of originalism, let me very briefly conclude here by saying, look, originalism is a craft. It could be performed well or poorly, and some of the opinions that I know folks in this crowd hate, as some that I do, involve bad originalism and bad textualism. It's also true that originalism cannot undo the cultural harm that non-originalist opinions have wreaked on this country. You look back and see how, for example, the cultural understanding of abortion and of what human sexuality ought to be has been corrupted by Roe. Dobbs is not going to change that overnight, and obviously legislative efforts in the aftermath of Dobbs are hampered by the fact that Roe was around for nearly 50 years. But to conclude, I think originalism has been a great success in overturning Roe and in building a Supreme Court faithful to its role. We need a conservative legal movement and a conservative movement more broadly that doesn't expect originalism to do the work that we citizens are called to do through legislation, cultural renewal, and other efforts. Thank you.